It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 1-800-313-9443.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Yeah, we're not afraid here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every weekday, Monday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Standard Time on the Republic Broadcasting Network from beautiful Phoenix, Arizona at Freedoms, with an S, freedomsphoenix.com studios. In studio, we have Bud Burrell. And, you know, go to the archive of this show today, and you'll get all the links and all the wonderful things everybody says about him and why he's such an expert. But I want to get right to it. Now, the phone number, we'll go ahead and take some calls, but, man, you guys better be on topic, you know, because we got a lot of really good information to add to this archive, and I do not want to be going off in the Netherlands. But the phone number is 800-313-9443. Now, in this short segment, we'll go ahead and go to David in Canada, because, David, you're living under some kind of government health system. How's that working out for you?
Yes, my name's David Raymond Amos. Have you heard of me? I just sent you an email to prove the sincerity of this call. I'm hard on topic.
So get on it. Let's do it.
Yes, Mr. Burrell, he just mentioned a lot of words in the same sentence. He mentioned Marco Polos, the guy that blew the whistle on Bernie Madoff, and he mentioned Medicare fraud.
There's a question in here somewhere, I'm sure.
Yes, the Inspector General of New York, the new one, Judge Fish, told me to take up my issues concerning Medicare fraud with the Inspector General in Washington as I was defending a lady in Long Island, New York, with her concerns about Medicare fraud. Marco Polo's lawyer was a lady from Canada, and yes, Marco Polo's was a whistleblower over Bernie Madoff, but I'm the fellow that caused him to plead guilty, and I proved it to you, by the way, of the email I just sent you.
Okay, and you want
to... My question to Mr. Burrell is, does he know who I am?
I do not know who you are, I'm sure.
And the relevancy of that is, I mean, how can you add to the conversation here? You know, there's
on November the 18th and November the 20th, 2003, I caused very important hearings at the U.S. Senate Banking Committee entitled Review of Current Investigations of the Mutual Fund Industry. Anyone can check to see that the transcripts in the hearings have disappeared. I proved that to you in an email I sent you, sir.
Well, thanks for for the call and contributing that, and I'll make sure that I look it over, and maybe there may be another show that we can talk to you in the future, but I want to make sure we focus on understanding how this was done, why they change all these little nuances in the law to create a mechanism by which they do these things. That's what I'm focusing on today, because this archive is going to be up there forever and always, and I want to make sure we get this in, because I can't. It's my show, because I can do what I want. That's what I want to do. So this is what we're going to do. Now, we are up to, and we're running on the end of this segment, so we'll get into it heavy in the next large segment that we come back with Bud Burrell, but we're going to be talking about things like, credit default swaps. What the heck does that mean? What is that? Derivatives? These ratings at Moody's. My brother-in-law is a bond rater at Moody's. Works right there at Wall Street. Good guy, bad guy, deceived. Is he part of the system? He just doesn't understand. What? But we're going to talk about when we come back with Bud Burrell here in just a little bit on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock. Jet Lacy is always on the board. We'll be right back in just a little bit. That Georgia's always on my mind.
Oh, come on! It's time to declare your independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 1-800-313-9443. And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and in studio, Bud Burrell. We're talking about the biggest, giantest, most major, mega bank robbery. You know, to call it anything else is to be, I don't know, inaccurate. It's, you know, it's a robbery from us. That's what it was. It was the bank. You know, instead of it being a robbery of the bank, it's like a bank robbery. Banks robbing us. You know, that's what it really comes down to. So it's banking industry robbing us. Bank robbery. Now, what I want to do is we walk in this straight through. Now, the one thing that we kind of skipped over is after World War II, they had the Bretton Woods Agreement, which was I don't want to just totally ignore. I know a lot of things have changed and such, and then it was kind of abandoned in the 70s and so on. But it really, Bretton Woods kind of had this – the base of it was that the United States was going to be the reserve currency with the dollar, and that it was kind of pinky swear promise, kind of, you know, dry martini vermouth spread over it of gold. Okay, so tell us you know, how that basically was going to work, and then how it was abandoned or changed in the 70s. What was going on there?
Specifically, Bretton Woods was, you know, there's a huge cross set of interlinks between Bretton Woods and the creation of the United Nations. All these things were interlinked and occurring at about the same time, but Bretton Woods was the idea that there had to be a reserve currency for the world.
Why?
So that trade could be facilitated in a post-World War II environment where economies had been totally destroyed. As an example, Germany. Germany was laying in rubble. They needed to find some way to get businesses restarted, homes rebuilt in France, Germany.
Why is it always a government action, though? I mean, you know, it's just get government out of the way. Here, go rebuild. Have a nice day. You know, this is where it starts. It's this philosophy that you have to have some kind of a collective take from the taxpayers in America, you know, and go rebuild this country that, you know, I don't know that they deserve. I mean, the people, of course, you want to help them. I think, you know, voluntarily it should have happened.
Well,
but to do this was why?
Bretton Woods was done so that we wouldn't create the environment that existed after World War One. World War One left Germany in ruins. It led to the explosion of the so-called German hyperinflation of the Weimar Republic. It destabilized the world. It set the world up for the rise of Hitler.
Yeah, but they also put an enormous debt they could never pay back at
Correct.
That time, too. That was a whole other thing. So anyway, so they say we're going to have some kind of a world-denominated something. All right.
Correct.
So you're going to use the dollar because we got the atomic bomb and we can't. So we got the dollar being in there. Now, they accepted that, okay, because it's good as gold, okay? You can transfer... Then you have, it's Nixon administration, people are hyperinflating, I mean, they're just printing money like a bad boy. All of a sudden, you know, the value of the dollar is plummeting, gold's starting to go up, people are taking their firms, their Federal Reserve notes, and they're going to America and say, give me my gold. And then Nixon goes, oh, no, 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 no. You know, the jig's up, you know, we're found out, nope, we stop, we close it, it's not good as gold anymore.
Well,
that basically it?
Yeah, that trouble started actually before the end of World War II. People forget that when they did the Iwo Jima war bond tour with the heroes of the Iwo Jima and the flag rising, at that point in time, the Saudis were saying that they would sell no more oil to the United States except for gold. And that was a big impetus behind the Bretton Woods Initiative. That and the desire to ensure that Europe didn't spawn a World War III, which was very close. It was a close call. People today don't know how close we came to going into a third world war with the Soviets. And the reason Hitler was allowed to come to power by the British and the French, who could have stopped him at any point in time, is that they were so terrified of socialism wrecking their own countries, I mean, socialism meaning Stalin-style communism, totalitarian socialism, that they allowed Hitler to be erected in Germany as a bulwark, firewall, whatever you want to call it, between them and the Soviet Union. And they threw the Eastern Bloc to the wolves as part of that deal. So Bretton Woods was intended to ensure the economic recovery of France, Germany, Italy, for the purposes of ensuring that NATO had some sort of financial, economic, structural integrity. And it worked, along with the Marshall Plan, which was an enormous contributor. And it's one of the reasons General George Marshall, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff throughout World War II, but it was his initiative, the Marshall Plan, that made the Bretton Woods initiative actually functionally work.
Yeah, see, you know, we can go in a whole other show on it functionally worked, okay? It worked to what? Well, it created what we got now, so I don't know how much it worked. But, you know, the thing is that was the justification for it. We're going to have a strong West to defend against this evil East.
Correct. Cold War.
So you have the Cold War going on. Then we get to the point, you got the Saudis saying, look, man, we don't want your paper. You know, we're of a whole different culture that deals in, heck, our religion requires that we take actual commodities. You know, this paper don't mean anything. That's not a commodity. We need gold. So they go, oh, no. So you kind of do your machinations, a little CIA, put the right guys in, whatever. Now we're going to have the dollar, the petrodollar, as the denominations and reserve currencies for them dealing oil. Okay, so we got that. Then people want to come start turning in their gold, as was the promise. And Nixon administration said, whoa, time out, stop, because you're depleting our reserves. So we abandon that. What happened then?
What happened then was that Carter became president, and Carter literally took the economy and the confidence factor and destroyed it. In fact, I was vividly sitting on the first Boston trading desk. I remember this vividly in the early 1980, watching the Treasury bill trade for 90-day Treasury bill at 22.5% yield. 22.5% yield, not 2.5% yield, 22.5% yield. And I would tell you all that that has to be a consideration in this whole prospect, because it was the market turned on the election of Reagan, not him taking office. It started to turn right at that point, and it continued with strength from that point forward.
You got to kill your phone, man.
Sorry.
Now, so we have Carter comes in. He's we're going to go ahead and kill the confidence in our currency. How? What was it that he did that accomplished that? Because I remember, you know, I'm graduating high school in 79. I bought, you know, when I'm going out to buy my first car and all this other stuff, I remember interest rates were in the, you know, the 20s or something. It was you think now they're doing all this got to keep interest rates down. And I'm like, the cure of Volcker came in, said, raise it. That's the only way we're going to save the dollar. So now they're threatening Ron Paul. You do this audit the Fed thing, we're going to raise interest rates. And a lot of people are going, good. You know, I mean, that's the only solution other than just get rid of the Fed. That's my first choice. But, you know, the thing is that Carter came in and he destroyed the economy, went into a major recession then by doing what? What was it he did?
He basically destroyed the confidence in our trading agreements with our European partners and with the rest of the world. And he did it at the same time that he basically unleashed the programs such as the Community Organization Act, which became ACORN, that was 1977, and a lot of other very socialist-level initiatives, which were interpreted as such by the economy, by analysts, okay, by everybody overseas who invested in the American dollar, and they forecast negative futures for the dollar, for the American economy, negative growth.
Based on a philosophy
of socialism
that was behind this ACORN thing.
Correct.
Okay, so now let's understand this. Another socialist program, we're going to just take in the end result we want, like people in houses. So we're going to create a program to give them some kind of special advantage and no doc loan, kind of low, whatever the heck it was, that we're going to socially and economically engineer the peoples again into an end result. And be damned how the effect it's going to have on anything else in a capitalist mentality, that what made us great to begin with. We're going to abandon that and do this ACORN thing. Now, describe ACORN. We're coming up on a break here pretty soon, but I want to make sure that you take 90 seconds and give us a definition of ACORN.
ACORN is a community organization for the based on the Saul Alinsky model from Rules for Radicals. It is about how minorities and underclasses could organize and effectively use power against the structure of the government and the structure of the individual citizens.
Okay, to do accomplish what?
Accomplish what? Specifically to gain access to control of the assets of those parties. And the most important part of it was made stronger by Clinton, who people forget it was Clinton who gave teeth to the Community Reinvestment Act passed under Carter, and it was under him that the subprime mortgage scandal exploded. I mean, literally, and because they used to call the loans that were being done by in the name of that program ninja loans for no income, no jobs, no assets, and those loans eventually imploded. They were packaged, repackaged, split, securitized, and sold not just here in the United States, but sold worldwide. And they created a catastrophe in Europe, which many people don't understand even now. As an example, the United Kingdom is in far worse condition financially than we are, and it's because of securities we sold them.
Yeah, I remember, Iceland? They went down the tubes as an entire nation. They woke up next day going, what just happened?
Iceland was a national bankruptcy.
Now, when we come back, we're going to see how it's the same thing. It's all about a philosophy. Well, we're going to talk about that philosophy when we come back and what Acorn has been turned into. You guys need to know this because it's happening again right now. We'll be right back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Bud Burrell. Just a little bit.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Yeah, we're boogieing here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Bud Burrell. Yeah, they're in the control room dancing. Please put your shirt on. What we're going to do is make sure that we finish up on Acorn with Bud Burrell. Okay, now, Bud, go ahead. And Acorn was a program that started back in the Carter administration. We're going to put poor people in houses because that's the government's job, according to them. And now it evolved into what? Because we heard a lot about Acorn during the Obama campaign. Now we're hearing a lot about it. They're being paid. They're like this force out there doing census. You know, they're got their little GPS coming up to your front door saying, hello. I'm going, whoa, what up? How did this evolve into that? What was their role during the Obama administration? What are they doing now?
Obama's first job with Acorn, in fact, is the only job, real job I can determine he had before he became a professor of law, where he apparently never taught a class, was specifically he would go out and do community organizing efforts for Acorn in the black communities in Chicago, on the South Side principally. Acorn was designed to give them political power, and they would do community activist efforts, such as if they had a bank that was not making the appropriate number of so-called ninja loans to these unqualified borrowers to buy homes they couldn't afford, that were overvalued and artificially priced, as it were.
They'd Al Sharpton them. Well, they'd come in and do, you're not being fair, we're going to boycott and do it and protest and blah, blah, blah.
They would mobilize numbers. And one bank had 700 people show up in their lobby. They simply put the bank out of business.
Okay. So they became a force. Now, what are they now? I mean, how are they being used under the Obama campaign?
The Obama campaign used Acorn specifically to mobilize voters, principally in the primaries. I truly believe that Hillary Clinton lost in Ohio and Iowa to Obama because of the busloads of voters who came in to vote in the primaries in those states, trucked in from Chicago and other cities. And they are now, right now, in 14 lawsuits in 14 different states for voter fraud, both in the registration and manipulation. I mean, they found Acorn registrations for Mickey Mouse
Now I understand Popeye. This, but Acorn is what? Is it privately funded, or are they doing all this using government money? I mean, where's their funding?
They are funded under a program developed by the government for minority activities.
Okay, so there's taxpayer funds being used to create an organization that was used by Obama's campaign to become president.
Correct.
Okay, so now he's president. How are they being used now? Because, I mean, I know about this census thing. They got these guys out there targeting individuals, you know, so how are they being used now?
They're being used right now to manipulate the outcome of the census, which is crucial because it's the census that is used to create legislative districts to determine who has, you know, what areas under their authority control. And they're doing that to protect the seats of their vested interest, Democratic congressmen and senators. And they want to make sure that there's no surprises coming out of those districts and zones they control.
Okay, so now we see how government programs turn into government programs to protect government. Okay, I mean, this is, you know, how it works. Now, let's go ahead and get back to the bank robbery. All right, now you have all these mechanisms by which they're going to protect their bank robbery. All right, but, you know, get their man in there. Because Obama is, you know, he's a product of Wall Street. I mean, these guys are bad guys. He's certainly a tool. And the one thing, you know, one of the first jobs I think he got out of college, he's working for Kissinger. I mean, what does that tell you? You know, so I'm just, you know, I get it. So now we have the administration has now got a minority face on it, and they loves the peoples. You know, of course, they're ripping them off. But we need to understand also, go back and start to understand the financial instruments that they created in order to do this. Now we understand that they got big giant pools of money out there that they created. They're going to go rob. Now you have your Russian guys, you know, did it really simple with some letters. You know, now we need to do it on mass scale. Now billions isn't enough. We don't want your measly 5 billion. We need your like 5 trillion. Okay, you know, the 50 trillion. I mean, how are we going to do this? So we need to, you know, what do you think would be the one thing that we should focus on next? Is it credit default swaps, derivatives, the ratings by the different rating houses that would allow these monies they're accumulated to be invested in certain things? Oh, I know. Let's talk about that. You have this accumulation of money that they did in these various pension funds and so on. So you say your California retirement, state retirement fund, you got state employees, big giant chunks of money. And we had people in the last decade that were going about CAFRs, all right? You have the off book, you have your budget, and then you have this enormous wealth that's, you know, been invested by the states and municipalities that own a vast percentage of the stock market, and they can control it. They benefit from it. They have all this money on it. And with the value that they had in their portfolios, you could not pay taxes for 20 years. But that's all gone now. Okay. So while that was there, who controlled that money based on what? So you have California state treasurer has all these pension monies. He's supposed to manage them. And when we come back, there goes the music. When we come back, we'll talk about that very thing. How did they manage this money? How did they do that? How do they take it and get it transferred? Somebody had to sign a piece of paper. Who was that person, and what excuse did they use, and what mechanism? So you stay tuned. When we come back, we're going to get to the meat of how it was done with the modern instruments here on Declare Your Independence with Bud Burrell and Ernest Hancock.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 1-800-313-9443.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every day, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on RBN Network from Phoenix, Arizona, on freedomsphoenix.com radio and the studio here with Jet Lacey on the board. And some of the guys are all gathering around doing their activist stuff. They came back editing video and such from Yuma, having some fun listening to the show. They're going, whoa, what's up? This is pretty cool. Now, the one thing I want to get to right back to this, and we'll get into all the modern ripoff tools. There is a bucket of money in every state that has the retirement funds of their, and one of the biggest ones is California, okay, if not the biggest. You have the, you know, there's an administrator of the California Public fund, the retirement fund of the employees, and then the teachers, I think, is separate, right? So you have teachers, man. They got to have their own little thing because they want to get their, you know, whatever. So they have a big fund. You have the retired state employees of California. They got a big fund. Now, that needs to get access to by bad guys. They go, ooh, thank you for the billions and billions. You know, lovely money. We want to get it. Now, how they get it, somebody has to sign a piece of paper. Somebody, there is somebody somewhere that goes, yes, we're going to take this bucket of money here, and we're going to put it in your bucket. All right? How did that happen?
Okay, specifically with regard to collateralized debt obligations, collateralized mortgage obligations, which were big packages of securities. Wall Street worked with the rating agencies, Fitch, Moody's, S&P's, etc., and they determined how they could create a mix of different forms of mortgages with varying yields and varying expiration dates, and they would put them together along with a rating from the rating agency that would make them investment grade. That means A-rated or better, in some cases AAA, and they were backed by full faith and security of the state or the local government, but whatever the local credit was where the package of mortgages was coming from.
Okay, whoa, time out right there.
Yeah.
They create this financial instrument that is collateralized with all these mortgages and so on.
Correct.
And it's guaranteed by somebody? Where the heck that come from?
It is guaranteed typically by private mortgage insurance, which has been around for years, and or it is guaranteed by a local a public agency. Such a, in different states had different organizations, but there were various mortgage guarantors, and those mortgage guarantors would guarantee against the default of principal and interest on the mortgage portfolio as a whole.
Give me an example of a company that did that.
A great example is AmBac, American, which was a huge company. Another one was General Mortgage.
You know, see, my thing is that if you're, because when you go and you purchase a home, you're getting mortgage insurance if your home is doesn't have enough equity. Okay, so they say, okay, I got to get, you know, principal, interest, and insurance. Okay, taxes and insurance, a pity or whatever they call it.
Correct.
So my wife's a real estate agent. I hear her using these terms all the time. So they got principal, interest, insurance. Now, this insurance is a company that they're guaranteeing the value of that mortgage. Okay, to the bank, and I bet they have a concern about people foreclosing, I would imagine.
They have a small one, but the bottom line is they diversify it across such a large package of portfolios, or large set of packages of large sets of portfolios, that they didn't see it have any risk. The most obvious federal government agency that did this type of guarantee work were the two organizations now infamous, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
In about 2005, I think it was, we'd have Jim Rogers on a regular basis, and Jim on Charles Goyette Show I was producing. And every week he'd come on, talk, and I remember it was 2005 about in spring, and he goes, Freddie and Fannie's done. They just stopped doing their quarterly reports, and nobody's reporting on it.
Yes, at that time, President Bush actually asked Congress to investigate Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And Barney Frank, in 2006, when they took control of the Congress after the elections, Barney Frank was personally involved with the head of mortgages for Fannie Mae and the marketing man, Herb Moses. And he just simply blocked any investigation of Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac from 2006 on. And he had that power. And the bottom line is that there was, it became the beginning of the end. I can't tell you how many millions of individual investors in this country had their entire retirement accounts in this so-called AAA credit paper issued by the United States government, backed up by these mortgages that they'd issued to, it turned out, you know, to Howdy Doody and his friends. These people had no names, they had no credit, they had no assets, and they had no ability to even keep a home straight.
Because they were just looking to create a bucket of money. You know, they didn't care about it gets back and forth. They go trade, and this is what happens when you do collectivism. Buckets are created, and somebody wants access to
the larger the bucket, the more money Wall Street made.
Now, what happens is now we have a mechanism by which we're going to have this money transfer from these pensions and so on, because that's where the money is. You know, private, public, whatever, doesn't matter. So they have a criteria by which they're going to invest that money into the stock market or these different financial instruments. So they go, okay, well, it has to be investment grade, it has to be rated, blah, blah, blah. So then you get, you know, tell us about the ratings. You know, how are these companies influenced to do this stuff? You go to Moody's, I need this rated. What are they doing? How much research are they actually doing? What are they? I go to my brother-in-law and I go, well, how do you do it? He goes, well, we use, you know, government reports. And so I go, oh, well, hell, it must be true then. In, you know, how does this happen?
The mortgage ratings are obtained, or actually it's any securities rating, obtained by a questionnaire that uses a set of analytical questions about the financial condition of the asset, the security, the issuer, etc., and even examination of properties when they're large denomination properties. And that set of results, like how stable is the prices, How much have they appreciated in the last year, 2 years, 5 years? How much are they? What's the yield on that instrument? Like how much interest is being paid on that mortgage? What is the credit worthiness of the person making that payment? Is he going to lose his job?
If you know the questions,
correct,
you know, you can manipulate what the answers are going to be.
That's exactly what happened.
So they made sure that, you know, here are the questions that we have, and boy, if we don't know the right answer.
And they knew all the right answers, and the bottom line is none of these rating agencies had any really serious assets and that could be accessed by anyone suing them for a failure to do their job. In fact, today, three of the top mortgage rating agencies, which had always been AAA credits, as far as Wall Street looked at it, and on their ratings by other people, they're now triple B. They're down six levels. So the rating agencies themselves are no longer good credits.
Okay, so now we have the rating things taken care of. They say, yeah, it's a good investment. So these large sums of money are now taken and transferred over into this investment. And then what happens to it? Because that's when we start getting into this, you know, credit swaps and derivatives. And because once they take all this money, well, they're going to want to kind of insure it. They're going, you know what? We're going to hedge against, real estate prices will never go down. It's always going to go up. So we'll buy insurance on our principal. That's, we'll pay $10 million for a gazillion dollars that we put into this thing. Well, then they've got $10 million and the beneficiary, it's like buying a life insurance policy on someone, you know, and the ratings guy is going, yeah, he looks good. He sent us a picture. He's doing okay. What you don't know, he's, you know, in his deathbed somewhere. But they take and they put insurance on this investment to make sure they get their principal back. People that buy derivatives, that, you know, it's an investment financial instrument that's derived from an index somewhere or something, and they say, yeah, all these patients, all these investment funds, all of these different accumulations of these mortgages and so on, yeah, they're fine, and it costs this much for this insurance policy. Now, they don't like calling it an insurance policy because then you're regulated and so on, so they call it derivative. But what happens is, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here, this is how I understood it. I want to be the beneficiary of that policy. If I know this guy is going to keel over dead and he's got a $50 million policy, well, heck, I'll pay $20 million for make $30 million on this thing. So they go and they do that. Then they trade it to the next guy because they keep – and that's when you're doing the short selling and the naked shorts and all that. So start talking about how this was done.
Well, this was done on a conventional level. It was done privately between a issuer, like an AIG, and the person buying the credit default swap, which was a put option in derivative terms. It was an insurance policy in simpler terms.
It had nothing to do with the original investment. It had nothing to do with it.
Actually, what it is, it's a bet against that credit becoming weaker. And effectively, what they did is they didn't impose capital or other criteria on those derivative instruments so that they would be limited by the amount of actual money that could be delivered to, you know, pay off a claim.
So if you have somebody on their deathbed in the hospital, or any individual, you had, you know, 50 insurance companies writing policy on the same guy, whether he's going to die or not.
Correct.
Okay, so that's what it was. Now, people are trading that instrument, because I know this happened, because it happened in the mid-90s, in 94, 95, there were insurance companies going around trying to get a bunch of patriots together to take out life insurance policies that they were going to negotiate on the stock market. So I got these people having interest in me being dead. I'm going, how stupid is that?
Well, it's even much, when you look at the scope of the scale, it's breathtaking. Effectively, the derivative marketplace globally had obligations outstanding per side of in excess of $600 trillion. Now, you want a perspective on how big that is? That's just about four times the global national product of the world.
An impossible number.
Impossible.
Do they balance each other? A lot of people talk about derivatives. They go, yeah, well, when it's all a wash and you balance them out, the guys long, short, this, back, you know, it kind of comes out to zero.
No, these are not exchange. These derivatives were not like exchange-traded instruments. There was no standard uniform criteria as to how a claimant could get paid on, you know, if he wanted to sell his put. He could sell it. He didn't have to have a default by the underlying credit. He could just come back to the guy and say, I want to sell it. And they'd have to buy it from him based on whether or not there was a repurchase agreement in the contract. And so you had this huge variety of derivatives with all sorts of different terms and conflicts in it. And no one had a handle on it. And there was no common settlement, no common clearance. Like nobody could do anything to handle these things.
Now, we could spend a lot of time just on derivatives, but I just so you get it, a lot of people that understand derivatives more, they hate it when I do this. So you can understand it. It's just an insurance policy based on whether the weather, you know, when we first hit 100-degree day. You're betting on something.
It's a bet.
It's correct. A bet. And other people will take the bet and trade the bet and back on the bet and the bet and the bet. And for some reason, somehow, this gambling, this betting, this mechanism was making certain people in different funds so much money that people were jumping into it, not even understanding what they were jumping into.
Well, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you're the perfect hedge of a long put, a long insurance policy, is to short sell the credit underlying. Sell the stock short, sell the bonds of that company or credit short, because as it comes down, the value of the put is going to go up. And the bottom line is this was done over and over and over again on a scale you cannot comprehend.
So if the actual stock would be the person sitting there in their deathbed, and if you're selling their life short, you're going, hey man, this guy's going to die, I'm selling short on this, and as his, you know, closer he gets to the day of his death, I mean, your value goes up. That's how stocks work. The value goes down, you sell it short, you're making money. And because other people are paying, saying, no, he's getting better, you know, whatever, they just, because they can.
A derivative story of real relevance to this is,
but let me finish that. On the same time as you're, at the same time, you hold a life insurance betting that he's going to die. That goes up in value. So you're making money both ways.
Correct.
Okay. So now we understand the derivatives, and that's, you know, a very oversimplified explanation, but it's good enough. Now, you know, credit default swaps, they use that word. Is that the same thing?
Credit default swap is a put option. It means basically it says if this credit defaults, okay, I get to swap that credit policy for cash.
Okay, so that's the insurance policy.
Correct. And that's okay. When you see the $180 billion that went into AIG that no one would give an accounting of, 95% of that money went to people who owned those credit default swaps offshore or in other enterprises not related to the United States. And because there was no clearinghouse for those securities, because there was no, you know, settlement criteria, there was no law, no controls, the whole thing nearly imploded the entire financial system of the world.
So they say, we got to have this bailout too big to fail. Let's give all this money to AIG because they were the guys that are going to pay off Goldman Sachs on all their credit default swaps.
Correct.
So Goldman Sachs says, thank you very much for playing.
They took their $10 billion off the table. They repaid their TARP money and now made just had, in the first quarter of this year, a record revenue of $13 billion in quarterly revenue.
And the stock market's going through the roof again. Yay, yeah. We're all saved. Okay. Now, the one thing that I do want to get into in addition to this is that as we have this money, okay, as we start to understand what was done, then we have the Bank of International Settlements. Now, this is when I last year when I wrote this article after hearing your show, all of a sudden there were a couple things that popped up, and we'll get this in the next segment. Hopefully we can get it all in. You have the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland, right?
That's right.
In Switzerland, that's kind of like this, I don't know, Uber Central Bank that has a subsidiary, the Federal Reserve and some of these others, because they made the claim, oh, we're going to audit the Federal Reserve. Trust us, we'll audit them. And I'm like, who the heck are you guys? Congress can't even audit them. We got Ron Paul's bill out there to audit the Fed, you know, because the United States government can't even, you know, they take all this money. We don't get to know what they did with all this money we gave them because it went overseas. That's what they don't want us to know. And then we sit there and we go, who's this Bank of International Settlements? Most congressmen have probably never even heard of them.
It's better described as a financial nation. It has sovereign immunity. It may be in Switzerland, but it's a country in terms of the way it's structured. And it has complete sovereign immunity rights as an individual corporate person, okay, of its own nationality.
Now, then they have a thing called SEED, all right? This is when as I understood it, and you got to help me when we come back. I'm going to explain this, and you can explain it when we come back. When you do an initial public offering, IPO, of a stock, that actual certificate goes in the hands of a deposit trust corporation, which is a subsidiary of the Federal Reserve. They have the actual stock. Then all this other stuff is traded on based on, you know, where they perceive that value to be. What happens when the Federal Reserve audit comes up there bankrupt? Who gets that? We're going to find out when we come back on Declare Your Independence in just a little bit.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
In constant sorrow through his day, I am the man of constant sorrow.
Oh, here on Declare Your Independence, is it all about sorrow? Is it that bad? Is it really? Well, you know, things may be really bad, but you know what? All you got to do is declare your independence. I declare my independence. It's that simple. You don't even need a government form. You know, and everything just starts to, you know, take its proper perspective. Now, one thing that I want to get into in the short segment, we'll make sure we have Bud back because, you know, there's so much more to go into. But this one thing I want to get up, I remember seeing last summer they came up with this thing. There was a press release, you know, that they're bringing up this new thing called Markit. You know, what it was is they need to be able to do this settlement that you're talking about. Now, the settlement of all these derivatives and so on, they did this in Europe because they a couple of years before, they saw where this is going. And they said, whoa, 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 time out. Well, Sachs wasn't done with America yet, so they, you know, kind of pushed this off. But now they're going to have this kind of settlement. And I'm going, how are they going to settle this? Because when you have a stock that goes out and you have initial public offering, that actual stock gets deposited somewhere. You know, who has that? And when they do an audit of the Federal Reserve and they find them wanting, and this is kind of connected to that somehow, what is the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland say, thank you for playing, now it's all ours too? The actual stock, we actually own everything? Do what you can in a few minutes to try and explain this to me.
Back in the late 60s, there was a huge crisis in the failure of Wall Street to be able to process what was then the incredible trading volume of 6 or 7 million shares a day. They couldn't clear because of the rules for the old handheld carry-deliver systems and before the personal computer and the mini-computer, they essentially just broke down because they couldn't handle the volume of securities being physically carried from one broker to another when there was a sale or brought from one broker to another on a purchase. And it was so bad, they had to shut down the exchanges for half a day, twice a week. They had to shut down, they had to reduce the number of trading hours in the trading day because they couldn't deal with the trading volume that was coming through. In 1973, in recognition of that crisis, they determined to set up a short-lived organization they call the Depository Trust Corporation, DTC, 1C. Mm-hmm. Now, that organization, in turn, had a surrogate called CD Incorporation, which was their surrogate for settlement and clearance. DTC was nothing more than a custodian, and the person who helped them transact business and do buys and sells within the system was CD and Co., C-E-D-E. That's where the words came from. And the bottom line is it was then took on a life of its own, and today they hold in excess of $32 trillion in securities, including stocks, bonds, and all other forms of assets. And they have just described themselves as the Federal Reserve of stocks and bonds. They are not affiliated with the stocks and bonds, and they are in fact owned by the broker-dealers who clear and settle their trades through them.
Now, what this is, we're going to have another show on this, because I tell you, this is where the rubber meets the road. This is where actual ownership papers, the mortgage, the stock certificates of the companies, this is where it is. Somewhere, it's somewhere. And somebody's going to have to settle this mess out. And somebody's going to go, okay, there's a bankruptcy. We're going to distribute this out to who is owed. And let me tell you who they say is going to be owed. They're buddies. That's who's going to get it. The central bankers. It's already happened. It already happened. Well, prepare yourself. Buy food. Buy food, buy food. Oh, and we got silver coming too. Go to freedomsphoenix.com and you'll have this archive to go over and over. You know you need to. Declare your independence, and we'll see you again tomorrow.